Acme Lithium, a company positioned near the epicenter of lithium production in the United States. Since 1966, Nevada's Clayton Valley has been the primary production source for lithium in all of North America. Acme Lithium holds two promising lithium projects in the Clayton Valley region. Acme Lithium, U.S. trading symbol ACLHF, and in Canada, ACME. Web address, acmelithium.com. That's acmelithium.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis, fog of war, and yet, over these last weeks, it is possible to begin to understand the way Russia is conducting itself, its offensive operations in Ukraine, in addition to the reports of war crimes, which are under investigation at Bucha, at Irpin, at Rostomel, and other cities, in addition to the firing of artillery, that rocket artillery or cannon artillery on residential towers. There is a battle on the field right now, especially in the eastern part of the country, that describes sometimes the Great War, that would be World War I. Sometimes the Great Patriotic War, that would be World War II, fought by Russia. And sometimes none of the above. So I welcome Bradley Bowman of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He is a senior director of the Center on Military and Political Power at the Foundation. He's also an Army veteran, and he's taught at West Point. To understand what it is that I'm reading when I learn again and again about how the Russian forces are about to take or will take by tonight Mariupol. Brad, I have seen Mariupol fall within a week for the last 3 weeks. Why is this port city so important to the Russians, and what do we know about the Ukrainian defense of the city, and especially the idea that they're dug in the ruins of a steel plant? Good evening to you, Brad.
Good evening to you, John. It's good to be with you again, and thanks for the opportunity and the question. You know, I think the short answer is that Russia values Mariupol for one or two reasons. One is that it's location on the Sea of Azov and the port facilities that would provide to Moscow, which is always looking for another warm water port. And also that if you're going to have an unimpeded land bridge from Russia to Crimea, you really can't have that without controlling Mariupol. So I think those are probably the two primary reasons Russia is interested in taking that city and why they've devoted so much time and energy to that effort.
The city's been reduced, we're told. We don't have many pictures as we do in parts of the suburbs of Kyiv, but it's been reduced to rubble, especially this steel plant. At the same time, we're told unconfirmed reports of the Russians using chemical weapons in some fashion, claiming that they need to dig out the resistance in this steel plant. So immediately I got the image of Stalingrad. Is that a fair description of what we're seeing? And when you teach Stalingrad at West Point, or when young officers learn Stalingrad, what is the lesson of fighting a Stalingrad or defending a Stalingrad?
Well, you know, Stalingrad is one of those battles, one of those words that immediately conjures images of the worst possible urban fighting. And we know, and I think you and I may have said this in a previous interview, that, you know, cities are renowned for chewing up and spitting out invading forces. And I think the Russians, obviously, from their history, know that. And they are reluctant to send their forces when they can into cities, knowing that it gives the defenders a great advantage. And any numerical or technological advantage that an invading force enjoys quickly erodes in the context of urban warfare. And so if you're Moscow and you patently don't care about human rights or murdering civilians, then that kind of incentivizes you to sit off at a distance and launch artillery, rockets, and missiles into a city to try to wear down the will to fight. And sadly, I think that's what we've seen in Mariupol. And of course, the great tragedy here is, right, you know, this is the Russians now doing to others what was done to them during World War II. And it's a shame that more Russians aren't aware of what's being done in their name, because I think that would facilitate increase anger at this unprovoked war that Putin has started and how it's been conducted.
There are subordinate fronts, we're told, from the reporting that we get from commercial satellites, from satellites from NATO, subordinate fronts. And one of them is a Russian advance redirecting its armor against Luhansk and Donetsk Oblast. Now, here we have a wide open countryside, not urban fighting. We've learned that the Russians have been wasteful of their armor. What is it that they're doing that has resulted in so many ruined T-72 tanks on the road to, well, for example, on the road to Bucha, the site of the alleged war crimes? I'm told that it takes an hour to get out there because of all the Russian armor. What are they doing wrong?
Yeah, no, it's, I think one of the great surprises for most people, I think if we're being honest, has been how poorly the Russian forces have performed in terms of logistics and sustainment and combined arms operations. And for the uninitiated, by combined arms operations, I mean infantry, armor, field artillery, and aviation forces, along with other forces operating in conjunction with one another in an integrated, simultaneous way to bring combat effects on a particular point and that is overwhelming. That's what I mean by combined arms. And the Russians have been largely unable to do that. And that's quite surprising, right? So I think one of the lessons I'm going to take from this is you just can't focus on weapons and who has the most weapons and the most modernized weapons. You also have to look at, do they have the operational concepts in place and the leadership in place, both at the general officer level and also at the non-commissioned officer level, to integrate these capabilities in a way that allows them to conduct effective combined arms. And that's something the Russians have not demonstrated, frankly, in this conflict, which is, I think, one of the great surprises. And some of the statistics I'm seeing is that in terms of the hundreds and hundreds of lost tanks that we've seen the Russians lose, some of those are because of the direct action of Ukrainian forces employing the Javelin anti-tank missiles and other anti-armor weapons that they've been provided by the U.S. and our allies. And some of it is these tanks just running out of gas or having maintenance problems, and they're being abandoned by Russian forces or Russian forces who are not motivated. Their morale is low and have decided for any number of reasons that they just don't want to fight. And so the bottom line from Moscow's perspective, whether the tank is destroyed or whether it's abandoned or whether it runs out of gas, the effect is the same. You no longer have that combat capability on the battlefield.
I say, what are the Russians doing wrong? Let's go to the other side of the line. What are the Ukrainians doing right? Brad, from an amateur's point of view, I've read the histories, but I don't have battlefield experience. You make a plan, and then as soon as you meet the enemy, you tear it up and start all over again. But what I'm seeing here is apparently the new age of the infantry armed with anti-tank weapons. Is that a fair assessment? These small units seem to be defeating large armor units.
No, it's interesting. I was reading today, as I do, about, you know, kind of the latest on the battlefield. And I saw someone make the following comment, like that basically you have these Russian forces that are they're mechanized forces. You know, they're tanks and armor personnel carriers, and they can deliver a real punch. But in many cases, they're not accompanied by infantry. Right. And so you need infantry to take out infantry. Right. And so if you have armored forces that are advancing, they're not supported by infantry. As I saw someone say, it's like someone who has a great right hook, but a glass jaw. So, you know, they can deliver quite a punch, but they're also susceptible to one punch coming from you. And that one punch has been delivered time and time again by these Javelin anti-tank missiles. The United States has delivered thousands of those. And I think that's responsible for a good portion of the disabled or destroyed tanks that we've seen. So this, again, comes back to the lack of combined arms operations that we see the Russians conducting. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. But one of the reasons, I think, is that they do not have a non-commissioned officer corps like the United States does. And few armies do. And the Russians obviously do not.
Yes. Let's take the last minute to describe why NCOs are critical on the battlefield. Do they actually run the operation and you officer class are happy for it?
Absolutely. One of the first things I learned as a cadet at West Point and that I came to admire even more as an instructor years later at West Point is your best friend is your platoon sergeant or your first sergeant. And a good platoon leader, a good company commander, a good battalion commander, you listen to the advice of your non-commissioned officer because they're the ones that in the end implement the orders and keep good order and discipline in the ranks and ensure that the mission at least initially goes to plan. And that's why the American non-commissioned officer corps is the pride of the world. And I think that, you know, no one thing explains everything, but I think the lack of an NCO corps like the United States has explains a lot with what we've seen in terms of Russia deficiencies in Ukraine.
Bradley Bowman, Senior Director, Center on Military and Political Power, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batchelor.